Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the breast center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, in observance of Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month, Dr. Chagpar is joined by Dr. James Farrell. Dr. Farrell is director of the Yale Center for Pancreatic Diseases. Here's Anish Chagpar.
Let's start off a little bit talking about what pancreatic cancer is and what you do.
So pancreatic cancer is a cancer of the pancreatic organ. It's an organ that's pretty deep in our bellies, by sitting behind the stomach. And it's a fairly increasingly more common cancer. There's about 44,000 cases of pancreatic cancer in this country every year. So my role in pancreatic cancer is I work as part of a large multidisciplinary group at Yale, whereby I'm involved in both the diagnosis, the management, as well as the palliation and treatment of patients with pancreatic cancer. By training, I'm an interventional gastroenterologist and endoscopist with a specific interest in pancreatic disease. So I see a lot of patients who present with pancreatic disease. I see a lot of patients who are concerned about whether they have pancreatic disease or whether they're at risk for getting pancreatic cancer. And so I'm involved in the initial evaluation of those patients with a variety of endoscopic tests. Down the road, for patients who ultimately do get a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, you know, we're involved with the management in terms of deciding which patients should undergo surgical management, which patients should have chemotherapy or radiation therapy. And really, as part of kind of a larger multidisciplinary group, we're involved in the overall management of these patients really from the beginning of the diagnostic workup.
So, you know, a lot of people don't know a whole lot about pancreatic cancer, but pancreatic cancer was what Patrick Swayze had, right? And Steve Jobs.
Correct. I mean, there's a lot of notable people who have died as a result of pancreatic cancer. Patrick Swayze is one of the more recent individuals. Steve Jobs, we believe, had a variant of pancreatic cancer, a type of endocrine neoplasm or tumor of the pancreas. But again, still within the same broad family, it can often be just as bad. But it is quite a common cancer. So, you know, when you look at the overall lists for pancreatic cancer, it ranks about 9th overall in the country, right? But when you look at death from cancers, it jumps up to the number 4 spot.
Wow.
And in fact, by 2025, it's estimated that it could be the number 1 or leading cause of death from cancer. And there's a variety of reasons for that. That kind of takes a lot of people by surprise. So a variety of reasons for that. One is kind of it's really a disease of the elder generation. So the average age of onset is around 65 or so. So as the population ages, it's an issue, number one. Number two is a lot of the other cancers that we're all very familiar with. So the colon cancers, the prostate, the lung cancers, the breast cancers. You know, there have been some significant inroads in terms of early diagnosis and management, but not so much with respect to pancreatic cancer. And so they're doing better and pancreatic cancer isn't. And still the treatment regimens that are available for pancreatic cancer, and there have been some notable improvements, it's still a very difficult cancer to diagnose early and to treat effectively. So it is becoming a bigger issue. And here in the state of Connecticut, for example, we have some of the highest rates of pancreatic cancer and some of the highest rising rates of pancreatic cancer in the country. And, you know, it's becoming an increasing issue. We see it predominantly a little bit more so in men, a little bit more so in African Americans. Smoking is a very significant risk factor for pancreatic cancer. And everybody thinks about lung cancer. But in fact, you know, the second most common smoking-related cancer out there is pancreatic cancer after lung cancer. So it's a big issue.
So I think, you know, our listeners may be really surprised to hear how prevalent it is in Connecticut. Why is it in Connecticut that the rates are so high?
You know, I don't think we have a really good handle on it. It certainly was alarming when I heard these. I've just moved to Connecticut from California. So when I was doing my homework about moving to Connecticut, I was looking at these and looking at the data, and it is surprising. I think some of it is actually Connecticut has a very good track record, frankly, of recording what goes on with its with its people and its patients. I think that's part of it. But it is somewhat concerning that there is a definite increase in the incidence of pancreatic cancer. Again, not at an alarming rate compared to the rest of the country, but it's certainly up there. And is it higher rates of smoking? I don't have an answer for that. Is it the age distribution of the population? I think there's many factors, but the specifics are actually quite hard to tease out.
Yeah. So let's talk about risk factors for developing pancreatic cancer? Now, certainly you told us about smoking, but are there other things that put people at risk for developing the disease?
There are, and I think there has been much more research into this area in pancreatic cancer in the last 10 years than in the previous 100 years for a variety of reasons. And in fact, pancreatic cancer genetics is probably the most studied of all the cancer genetics out there because people have really piled into this area to work things out. We definitely are beginning to understand that there's a familial component to pancreatic cancer. So we think that about 10% of all pancreatic cancers have some sort of familial component. And often patients are unaware that this is going on until you begin to ask them. And then all of a sudden, you know, an uncle, an aunt or so had a similar type of disease. And the genetics of familial pancreatic cancer is being worked out. So there's some clear-cut genes that we can test for, like the BRCA1, the BRCA2 genes, the P16 genes. But still, the vast majority of familial pancreatic cancer, it hasn't really been worked out. And in that field, a lot of studies have arisen whereby we're actively engaging patients from families that have familial pancreatic cancer and trying to screen them at an early stage to see if they have lesions that might represent early pancreatic cancers. So the area of familial pancreatic cancer is certainly a concerning one. There are other areas then with respect to, for example, diabetes. So it's concerning that for patients who develop new onset diabetes after the age of 50 or so, that they perhaps are at an increased risk. Again, it's a small absolute risk because diabetes is very common in the population, but it certainly sends up red flags when we hear about new onset diabetes after the age of 50. We also get concerned about patients with established diabetes who, for some reason, their sugar starts acting erratically after a long time of stability. So the world of diabetes is kind of coming under our radar for us to figure out, you know, should we be looking at this group more closely as a risk factor for pancreatic cancer? Another big area that's also a concern, and we're being very proactive now at Yale in particular about doing this, is with increasing use of CAT scans and MRIs in the community for a variety of reasons, we're picking up a lot of incidental cysts, so small fluid collections in the pancreas. And we know that some of these cysts are pre-malignant or pre-cancerous. Now, there's a lot of these cysts out there, and somewhere between, you know, 3 to 5% of the population between the age of 60 and 70 will have these cysts. But obviously not all of them are developing into serious pancreatic disease. So through a combination of our understanding of these diseases, we have a pancreatic cyst clinic and the use of more invasive endoscopic procedures to biopsy and sample these cysts, we're getting to be pretty good at identifying what patients we need to be very aggressive with you know, removing these at an early lesion through surgery and what patients we can follow. So I think those are kind of the big three items in terms of, you know, risk factors. There's also issues of just chronic damage to the pancreas over time. So, you know, we talk about pancreatic cancer. The other big pancreatic disease, for example, is pancreatitis. And everybody knows that alcohol is ultimately very deleterious to your pancreas. So if you develop damage to your pancreas from alcohol, so the disease is called chronic pancreatitis, it puts you at an increased risk of developing pancreatic cancer, probably an eightfold risk compared to the rest of the population. But there's other things that can cause chronic pancreatitis. And in fact, there's hereditary forms of pancreatitis. So this is now different than familial pancreatic cancer. And so this has been very well worked out. We know the genes that are involved. We know the families. We can test for the genes. Those particular individuals are probably anywhere between a 40 to 60 fold increase of developing pancreatic cancer. So they need a lot more close attention. So, you know, while it's very alarming at a certain level, one of the very gratifying things about this field is that tremendous progress has been made in understanding. And it's really up to us now to put a lot of our knowledge to work to try and help some of these patients.
So let's suppose, you know, our listeners are listening to us on Yale Cancer Center Answers on Sunday evening and thinking, geez, you know, I have a lot of those risk factors. What are the signs and symptoms that people should prompt them to go and seek medical attention? Or is a risk factor enough to go to your doctor and say, you know what, my sugars have been acting erratic and I just got diagnosed with diabetes after the age of 50? Or, you know, I'm a smoker and, you know, I had a history of chronic pancreatitis. What should people be looking for in terms of signs and symptoms?
Sure. I think it's really governed by two issues. One of the unfortunate issues is the fact that a lot of pancreatic cancer at an early stage is asymptomatic.
Mm.
And so as a result of that, I think we have begun to focus and would tell people who fall into these high-risk groups. So if there is a real family history of pancreatic cancer, if they have a pancreatic cyst, if there is something about their diabetes, again, which is a very common disease that they're concerned about, you know, it's something that they should certainly bring up with their physician. And then the physician can coordinate, you know, a proper management plan based on that. For people who don't really fall into those groups, the symptoms of pancreatic cancer, when it does become symptomatic, are unfortunately very nonspecific. So we're talking about abdominal pain. We're talking about weight loss, which should certainly alarm anybody who's got new onset abdominal pain or weight loss. It doesn't mean that it necessarily has to be pancreatic cancer. There's many, many other things it could be. But those symptoms alone should be enough for someone to say, you know, I need to get this sorted out. One of the problems with pancreatic cancer is the location of the pancreas itself is so deep that, you know, when you have the pancreas itself, we have an area of the pancreas called the head of the pancreas, and that's where the liver drains through. So when something goes wrong there, the liver gets backed up and the patient may turn yellow. So that can be an early warning sign for us. If, however, you have something that's going on in the body or tail of the pancreas, unfortunately, things can develop there to quite a stage and the patient can be completely unaware of it. So it is a problem of some very non-specific symptoms, some late presentations. We've also, you know, recognized there's some subgroups of patients such as the diabetics or patients who develop with pancreatitis, so an inflamed pancreas, which in a certain age group, to us at least, says, you know, we need to make sure that you don't have an early pancreatic cancer or something that could develop into cancer. But I think it kind of follows good medical advice for any patient with any sort of new symptoms that may be attributable to this to at least seek medical advice. Again, you know, we talk about some of the alarming rates of pancreatic cancer. The absolute rates are still relatively low compared to heart disease and other lung diseases. So I think, you know, patients need to keep those issues in mind as well.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned that I want to come back to is that there now are screening tests because, you know, if we have people who are at high risk, potentially we can screen for cancers and pick them up early. So tell us a bit more about how do you screen for pancreatic cancer? I mean, a lot of people know that they should get a mammogram to screen for breast cancer or a colonoscopy for colon cancer. What do you do for pancreatic cancer and who should be getting screened?
It's still a very controversial subject and it's, again, a kind of an active area of work, but there are some clear issues coming to mind. There's no simple blood test, for example, whereby you can go out and get a blood test and say, I do or I don't have pancreatic cancer. There is a tumor marker called CA19-9, but it lacks really what we call the sensitivity or specificity. So it isn't the perfect test for it. And so we don't recommend it be used routinely. There is a lot of work going on, and we've been involved ourselves in the developing of saliva-based biomarkers. Mm. One of the big problems with a lot of these tests is that they are also found in patients who don't have pancreatic cancer. And what our concern is that a certain number of patients will be falsely worried and anxious as we go through the screening process. So what we're working on really is focusing on patients who are at higher risk. And so for those groups of patients, we do blood tests. We sometimes look at pancreatic juice that we collect from the pancreas. We use a variety of imaging tests, so MRI scans of the pancreas, CT scans of the pancreas, as well as endoscopic ultrasound, to really begin to identify what's considered an early cancer, or even possibly, I mean, the holy grail here is to find a precancer, something before it develops into cancer. And I think for those groups, I think it's becoming reasonable to think about screening with invasive procedures such as an endoscopic ultrasound, which is a very high resolution modality imaging for looking at the pancreas to see if we can pick up pancreatic cancer early.
Well, we're going to pick up on that conversation right after we take a short break for a medical minute. So please stay tuned to learn more information about pancreatic cancer with our guest, Dr. James Farrell.
The American Cancer Society estimates that over 1,000 patients will be diagnosed with melanoma in Connecticut each year. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. Early detection is the key. When detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable, and new treatment options and surgical techniques are giving melanoma survivors more hope than they've ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers like the one at Yale to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. The Specialized Programs of Research Excellence in Skin Cancer Grant at Yale, also known as the SPOR Grant, will help establish national guidelines on modifying behavior and on prevention, as well as identification of new drug targets. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
This is Dr. Anish Chagpar, and I'm joined today by my guest, Dr. James Farrell, and we are discussing pancreatic cancer, particularly given the fact that this is Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month, lest any of you didn't know that. I certainly didn't. So, James, right before the break, you were telling us something that I found very intriguing, which was the fact that although it still seems to be in its infancy, that there are a variety of imaging modalities that we can use to kind of screen for pancreatic cancer. Tell us more about what those tests are and how involved they are. What is it like for a patient?
Well, we're beginning to use more tests such as MRI scans as well as CAT scans, but preferentially MRI scans because of the lack of radiation. And now we get very good imaging of the pancreas with that. And we're beginning to pick up very small lesions such as small cysts, which we think might be associated with the development of pancreatic cancer. So in the right population, you know, this becomes a very interesting finding for us. So that's a non-invasive study. Doesn't require the patient to be sedated per se. Takes about maybe a half an hour or so. It gives a lot of information about the pancreas in incredible detail. On a kind of a slightly higher level, then we have to make decisions about whether we do more invasive but safe procedures. And really a very common one is called an endoscopic ultrasound. And this is available, you know, at a variety of institutions around the country. It's becoming more common. It's like an upper endoscopy. So if you've ever had an endoscopy to look for an ulcer or to check up your heartburn, it's very similar to that. But it has an ultrasound probe that allows us to look very closely at the pancreas. So we can see all aspects of the pancreas in incredible detail. But almost as importantly, it allows us to biopsy things within the pancreas very safely. And so in former times, if you wanted to biopsy the pancreas, it used to be a big production, either involving a CT scanner or a surgeon. And now we can do it a really minimally invasive procedure, such as the endoscopic ultrasound. So we can stick a very small needle in very safely, painlessly into the pancreas. We can biopsy it. We can collect fluid from these cysts and really try and understand what's going on in a patient's pancreas. So it's one of the kind of the great advances over the last 15 or 20 years or so, and has really pushed the area of pancreatic imaging so that we're beginning to understand what we're dealing with, again, in certain specific populations.
Can you tell me more about those populations? Are those the people who would be genetically tested to be at higher risk, or who would those be, and how frequently should they be getting these studies?
Well, I think for patients who are incidentally being found to have pancreatic cysts, again, through this kind of modern epidemic of imaging being done and patients found to have incidental abnormalities in their pancreas, they certainly undergo an intensive evaluation initially with MRI scans, with endoscopic ultrasound. But then we end up stratifying them and we decide, you know, you need to have this area removed to your pancreas, or you need to be left alone for a couple of years, and we'll check in again in 1 or 2 years. And we're getting better at understanding what patients we can leave alone and what patients we need to be aggressive about. For patients who do have a family history, a lot of those are being studied, such as places as Yale and other institutions around the country, as part of protocols whereby they are enrolled, actively managed, they see a genetic counselor, their risk is assessed, and then decisions about how often they need an MRI, for example, how often they need an endoscopic ultrasound is decided upon. And invariably, they need some form of ongoing surveillance, be it yearly with an MRI or every other year with an MRI and an endoscopic ultrasound.
Well, I mean, that sounds like that really is pushing the forefront of finding pancreatic cancer early.
I think it's important for us. I mean, there's two wars on pancreatic cancer.
Yeah.
One is obviously a treatment. And still, there's a lot of patients presenting at very late stages with pancreatic cancer. It's one of the big issues with pancreatic cancer. But I think the other front is really in the world of early detection. And how do we detect these lesions early at a stage that they could undergo surgery? So only about 15% of patients who present with pancreatic cancer are eligible to undergo surgical resection. And they do better long term, but only 15% of all patients are presenting that way. So if we can kind of increase that number and try to pick up those patients earlier, that will be great. Again, as I said earlier, the holy grail will be to try and find patients before they develop into cancers. And so that's why there's such a hot area of interest in this world of pancreatic cysts, and frankly, looking at patients who are considered to be at high risk.
Yeah. So let's talk about the management of pancreatic cancer. So you mentioned that about 15% can be treated with surgery and that they do better than if they're not eligible to be treated with surgery. But what's the surgery like?
So the surgery for pancreatic cancer is a big proposition. It involves removing all or a portion, more often than not, just a portion of the pancreas. A lot depends on the location of the pancreas cancer. So if it's in what we call the head of the pancreas, patients undergo a Whipple procedure, which is named after the original inventor of the procedure. And it's a fairly involved procedure that really should only be done in expert centers by very experienced surgeons. And that's been one of the kind of the great developments over the last 10 or 15 years, is the realization that if you need pancreatic surgery, you really need to be in the hands of a very experienced surgeon at a high volume center. So it is a big proposition. It is a big surgery. But now in good hands and in safe hands, the mortality is approaching 0%. It is associated with morbidity in a recovery period. But I think for this group of patients, because it does improve the odds, it's really highly sought after. And it really, you know, we do our best to try and identify patients who are eligible for pancreatic surgery. But unfortunately, it's still a relatively small number of the entire population.
So what happens to the other 85% of people?
So the other 85%... are not initially eligible for surgery because they either have involvement of major blood vessels in the area or their disease has spread to, for example, the liver or the lung at the time of presentation. Now, a small percentage of them over time and with treatment may become eligible for surgery, but the vast majority of them are still dependent on combinations of chemotherapy predominantly, as well as radiation therapy. And therein lies one of the big problems with pancreatic cancer, is that we really haven't had great drugs to try and tackle this disease. It's changing, and there's a lot of new exciting developments in the area. But really, for that 85% of the population, they're dependent on some form of chemotherapy with or without radiation treatment to try and help them.
And so, you know, for a lot of cancers, the big buzzword these days is targeted therapies and personalized medicine. Where are we on that front in pancreatic cancer?
So personalized medicine in pancreatic cancer has been my personal hobby horse and holy grail for the last 15 years. And I was involved in identifying a marker that was associated with a group of patients that did particularly well when they were given the common drug used in pancreatic cancer, which is gemcitabine. And so we're still studying that area. The particular marker is called HENT1, and it's a marker that allows the drug to get into the cell, for example. So if your tumor has that marker and you get gemcitabine, you do well. So we're beginning to look more closely at this as a possible treatment option, or at least to identify that subgroup of patients that if they had that marker, they would benefit from that treatment and allow other patients who don't have that marker to go in a different direction with another treatment. And so I think within the area of pancreatic cancer, like other cancers, quite frankly, I think there is a big push and a big understanding now that not all these pancreatic cancers are the same. They probably, of course, should not be treated. And there's many, 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 many subgroups. So we're beginning to understand it. We're beginning to see these subgroups. We're beginning to identify the drugs that these subgroups would benefit from. With respect to the issue of targeted therapy and better treatments for it, as I said, there's been much more work done in the genetics of pancreatic cancer than, frankly, any other cancer in the last 10 or 15 years. We know a lot about pancreatic cancer now, about the mutations involved. And people are developing ongoing treatments that are based on that, but it's still early stages and it might require multiple drugs and multiple combinations of drugs. What has happened in the last 2 to 3 years or so are new drug trials and new combinations of treatment that have really advanced the management of patients with locally advanced and metastatic pancreatic cancer. For a long time, we were dependent on a drug called gemcitabine. In most recent years, we've added a drug called nab-paclitaxel, and then recently FOLFIRINOX. And these are really kind of making a dent in patient survival, but unfortunately with metastatic and locally advanced disease. So there has been some progress, but I think the area of targeted therapy is still an evolution for pancreatic cancer, as well as personalized medicine, but there's a lot of people who are pushing that agenda.
So the last thing that you mentioned kind of in passing was radiation therapy. So we know that if you present really early, you may be able to get surgery and do very well. And then there's chemotherapy. Who needs radiation and what's that like?
Yeah, the role of radiation therapy has been actually quite controversial in pancreatic cancer. And for a period of time, it actually gone out of favor for the management of patients who've got what we call locally advanced disease. So they've got disease that's confined to their pancreas, but they're not able to have surgery because it's involving the major blood vessels. And so radiation therapy had been used and is still used for that group of patients with a view to, in addition to chemotherapy, you know, trying to shrink down the tumor. Also for patients who'd undergone surgery, for example, and had their tumor removed, there has been a role for radiation therapy in the management of those patients after surgery. But again, it's still a controversial subject. I think as drug regimens get better, I think most physicians and most treating physicians would really like to push the concept of chemotherapy over radiation therapy. But again, it's still kind of a controversial area.
So I want to get back to one of the statistics that you gave us early on in the show, which is that over time in the next decade or so, the mortality associated with pancreatic cancer may in fact be at the top of the charts in terms of all cancers and the mortality associated with that. Why is that? Is it that we're just finding it late? Is it that all of this research is just going too slowly? What's it going to take to get that mortality back down where it belongs? Closer to zero would be preferable.
I can tell you that there's a lot of people in the country and the world who are passionate about getting this mortality rate down. And one of the organizations that I'm involved with is also very active here in Connecticut, PanCAN, has set the goal for doubling the survival related to pancreatic cancer by 2025. And they are passionate about getting this done through research, by getting patients, by getting patient advocates, patient families, and just people interested in pancreatic disease involved. But the two big challenges are the issue of early detection and the issue of treatment. And also the fact that, yes, there have been other gains made in other diseases and other cancers. And so those two things are being tackled. And because there have been some advances in our understanding, as well, frankly, as the treatment of pancreatic cancer, I mean, I think there is optimism that either a new treatment regimen or a treatment regimen for a subgroup of patients who have pancreatic cancer, you know, will benefit and will help kind of move that needle a little bit and kind of get to those goals by 2025. But it is a challenge. And likewise, with early detection, I think through combinations of new blood markers, our understanding of who's at risk, we're making slow dents in this overall kind of very, very grim statistic.
Yeah. And it seems to me that, you know, there's all kinds of really exciting research going on in the field of pancreatic cancer on all of those fronts, on early detection, on looking at the genetics of pancreatic cancer, and on treatment. But all of this also requires the commitment of patients to participate in clinical trials. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's a big issue for patients with pancreatic cancer, and some recent studies have suggested that really the enrollment of patients with pancreatic cancer in trials is very, very low in this country. And so PanCAN, for example, and other organizations are really pushing the agenda of increasing enrollment. We cannot begin to understand anything about disease without patient involvement, about understanding how the drugs work, why they work, and really kind of, you know, moving forward in this field. And I think the message is getting out. And I think the message is getting out that patients need to be counseled about the importance of being involved in pancreatic cancer trials, in that shouldn't be seen necessarily as a negative or truly experimental things, in that there is a probability now with some of these new regimens they may actually receive a benefit. And I think that word is getting out, but we've got a long way to go. And it's a two-way street, right? So we want to learn, we want to help as physicians and researchers, and patients want to learn and patients want to be helped by this, as do their families.
Dr. James Farrell is director of the Yale Center for Pancreatic Diseases. If you have questions or comments, we invite you to visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of previously broadcast episodes. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.